We're starting with Absalom's death, chapter 18, verse 1. Okay, someone asked the question, what if David would have committed adultery but would not have killed Uriah? What would have happened? It's hard to know, but I'm sure a lot less would have happened negative to David. I'm sure there still would have been consequences, but I don't think it would have been to the same extreme. That's my opinion. Then the person, Ahithophel. Ahithophel's granddaughter, Bathsheba, there's this immorality. Then Uriah is killed. Now Ahithophel knew under the law that he had, in essence, the right to charge David with the death penalty, because David deserved the death penalty. So Ahithophel, what his problem is that he gets into a wrong spirit, and instead of allowing the Lord to bring judgment to David, because the Lord was going to bring judgment to David. I mean, Nathan knocked on the door. Incidentally, it did take a year for Nathan to knock on the door. You do realize that. You know, some folks want everything to happen immediately. It was a year before God sent Nathan. So you could say, hello. Yeah, I mean, hurry up, God. And the Lord did it that way because he wanted certain processes to work in David's heart in that year period. But the Lord told Nathan, the judgment's coming on David, but Ahithophel didn't want that judgment. He wanted to work his own judgment on David. So Ahithophel gets this bitter spirit to work judgment on David, of which God was going to judge David anyway. But Ahithophel ends up losing his life in the process. And the moral of the story is Romans chapter 12, verse 18 to 21. It says, God says, vengeance is mine. Leave room for the wrath of God. Which means, don't take the wrath yourself. I will do it to the person. The problem in the flesh is that God's wrath is always slower than man's wrath. Man's wrath, James 1:19, he says, don't be quick to speak. Be slow to anger, slow to show wrath. Man is quick to show wrath, and God is slow to show wrath. And that's the difference. And so in Romans 12, he says, verse 17, make room for God's wrath. But man says, Ahithophel says, Lord, I gave you, it's 20 years. I mean, I want the guy nailed. God says, I will bring great wrath, or at least great discipline and judgment upon David before the whole nation. And already it started because of Tamar and Amnon, etc. But if Ahithophel would have given the wrath of God, if he'd have yielded to it instead of taking it himself, he wouldn't have lost his life. So that's a man who had a true cause. David deserved judgment. David deserved death. Ahithophel knew it. But Ahithophel took it into his own hands with a bitter spirit and lost his life in the process. And David still got judged, but Ahithophel never really fully got to witness the full judgment upon David. Because David's judgment doesn't even end right here. It continues. And so we don't want to get a bitter spirit and take judgment into our own hands and go fast instead of slow. We want to go slow in our judgment, but we don't want to be so slow like David with his sons. He never dealt with them. I mean, it's a difficult balance. So when there's a difficult balance, what is the moral of the story? Is that we're generous in our judgments towards one another. Good. Okay, let's go ahead and start with this. Okay, Roman numeral 3, Absalom's death. And David numbered the people who were with him, and set captains of thousands and captains of hundreds over them. Now remember, multitudes have rallied to David now because Hushai's counsel has provided time, right? Now the news of the revolt is everywhere, so people are choosing. A lot of people didn't even know there was a revolt against David, so they didn't even think to go rally to him. So a certain sort of now rallied to David over the I guess weeks or months. I'm not sure the time frame. I'm sure there's hints of it. I just don't know what it is yet. I haven't seen it. But when you read this real careful, there's hints of that stuff everywhere. So David sent one third under Joab, one third under Abishai, and one third under Ittai. Okay, and David said, I will surely go out with you myself. So David feels responsible. He says, hey, I need to be there. I mean, I'm the one that got this whole thing going. He's still got the same courage. He's not at all afraid that he's going to lose this thing. But the people answered and said, you can't go. For if we flee away, they don't care about us, nor if half of us die, will they care about us. But you are worth 10,000 of us, for you are now more help to us in the city. Now, This, now I don't think that they're thinking what we might be thinking when we're reading it. They're not saying that David as a human being is worth more than them as a human being. They're saying David as a political player in this game, the unfolding of this drama. If they kill David, the war's over. If they kill 10,000 of them, the war still isn't over until David's gone. So that's what they mean. They're not, I don't think that they've lost their brains here, and they think David as a human being is more important than they are as human beings. But in the political unfolding of the Civil War, David was much more important for the defeat of Absalom. Because if David died, Absalom wins. If 10,000 of them die, still Absalom hasn't won yet. That's what they mean by that. Well, incidentally, another question was answered in the break about the difference between Absalom's political spirit in a negative sense and David's, what I've been calling his diplomacy, which looks like a divine politics. And they go, what's the difference? And I think there is a difference. Number one, David never ever wanted to be king. That was never his drive, his ambition to be over the nation. David used diplomacy so that he could get dissenting factions in the nation in unity so that a unified nation could defeat the Philistines. David wanted unity for effectiveness for the good of everything. Absalom wanted, he used his political kissing of the hand in a false way, showing personal affection that wasn't real, because he wanted to be over the nation. He didn't care who died. He didn't care what law was broken. He didn't care if the cities were burned. He wanted to be king. So it's motive that is the difference between manipulation and diplomacy is motive. Because David wanted to pursue the nation and made very strategic alignments and favors so that carnal offended people would unify and cooperate with other carnal offended people so the nation could be preserved. That's what his motive was, the good of the nation, and Absalom's motive was his own rule over people. So Absalom was a manipulator, but David had diplomacy. And there's like 10 of these times where David made these very strategic moves, but again, so the nation would in unity dwell together and defeat the enemies of the Lord. So there's that's the issue of motive that is the difference. Okay, so the people answered and said, "You shall not go out, but you're worth 10,000 of us." Verse 3. And the king said to them, "Whatever seems best to you, I will do." So he submits to the counsel of his leadership team there. And so the king stood beside the gate, and all the people went out by hundreds and by thousands. So I think another thing that God's doing through this leadership team, David submits to them, he's removing David from the equation so that Absalom gets killed. Because remember where it said a couple verses earlier, where was it in chapter 17, that the counsel of Ahithophel was overturned so that God could work his destruction on Absalom. God wanted Absalom under judgment. And so if David would have been there, David would have stopped it. So the leadership team says, "No, David, you stay here." And I even see God's overruling hand in that. So David says, "Okay, one command." He says, verse 5, "Deal gently with, for my sake, with the young man Absalom." And all the people heard the king give all the captain's orders concerning Absalom. One reason, I think, is that David does have this affection for his children. It ends up in an inordinate affection. I mean, it's beyond the boundaries of even righteousness, because he would let God's law be broken and let his children continue in sin. So I think it was a little inordinate. His softness. I mean, he is a king with great authority, and he's letting them get away with so much because he ended up endangering the whole nation through being too soft on his children. It was more than just a father and his, you know, family. It's a man and a nation at stake too. But secondly, I think David felt responsible for this whole scenario. I think David in his mind is thinking, if I would have never have done this, Absalom would never have been rebellious. I don't think that's true. I think Absalom had a rebellious heart bigger than David's deficiencies. Now, obviously, a rebellious heart can get worse and worse and worse with more liberty. But I think David is thinking, this whole mess wouldn't be here if I wouldn't have sinned. So he's trying to be soft on everybody. So David is torn. He's got this major tension. So the people went out to the battlefield against Israel, and the battle was in the woods of Ephraim. So the people of Israel were overthrown there before the servants of David. And a great slaughter of 20,000 took place. So all in one day, 20,000 people. 20,000. Then in verse 8, it says, "The battle was scattered over the face of the whole countryside, and the woods devoured more people that day than the sword devoured." which it doesn't give the details, but typically when it means the woods devoured them, it means the wild animals in the forest, because there were wild animals all over Israel. That's one thing God told Israel in Deuteronomy 7:22. He said, I want you to take the nation little by little. He goes, I don't want to give you the nation in a week, because you can't inhabit the nation. And if you just kill everybody without mobilizing the nation, then the wild beasts will multiply and devour you. Which is the kind of a spiritual principle of the Lord saying, if I give you all of your promises too quick, pride, the wild beast will devour you. So God typically gives us the land little by little. Because if they would have wiped out 5 million inhabitants of Canaan, but could not have organized, the lions and tigers and bears would have multiplied everywhere, and then they would have defeated Israel. And God, that's a picture of human pride too. God gives us our promises little by little. But anyway, the woods, there's wild animals in the woods. Now, I imagine that this was the wild beasts were stirred up by the Lord. This is an unusual. I mean, having more than 20,000 people killed in one day by the woods. I mean, there. I see this as a divine intervention. This is not just bad luck, with bears. I mean, we're talking 20,000 men. More people died. I mean, I don't know how else to say it. I didn't mean to be funny. But so now we have 20,000 killed by the sword and more than that devoured in the woods. So let's say 20 or 30,000. So we're talking nearly 50,000 people are lost in this world. Why are 50,000 of Absalom's ranks being slaughtered? Because this is the army coming against David. When it's David's sin to set the whole thing up. We'll talk on this, that David's sin, when he numbered all of Israel, 70,000 in the nation were killed because of David's sin. So when a person in this place of authority in God's purpose, I mean, there's, 5 million people in the nation, maybe more. I know there's 1.3 million soldiers, so at least 5 million people in the nation, maybe 10. I don't really know the number. But so David's in a position over 5 or 10 million people, and his sin impacts the nation. And that's just how it works in the spirit. I mean, it's all connected together. And the Lord wanted to remove, I mean, the Lord does 10 things at one time, doesn't he? When the Lord moves his hand over something, he judges, sins, and trains people, and sets wisdom in its history, and blesses and curses. He does it all with one swoosh of his hand across a nation. Now the rebels who defy the king are being removed from the nation as well. The people that would rebel against the king are also being judged as well, which to me is purifying the nation for Solomon's reign, which is just around the corner. 7 or 8 years later, Solomon is going to inherit this nation, and a whole lot of the rebels of Absalom are gone now. So the Lord does many, many things when he touches a nation. Okay, so the woods devoured more people that day than the sword. B, Joab kills Absalom. And Absalom met the servants of David. Absalom rode on a mule. The mule went under the thick boughs of a great tree, like an oak tree. His head, because remember in chapter 14, 26, he had that beautiful hair. He had that, hair that was famous. And it was real long and thick and beautiful. And he, cut it and weighed it and everything. And combed it. He did everything with it. And everybody adored his hair, So it was really, it got caught in the woods. And he was, and the tree here, he was left hanging because the mule kept on going. And he's stuck there and his hair is entangled. And the Lord has ordered this where the mule continues to move. So he's stuck there and he's just hanging there for possibly several hours. And his hair is there. Incidentally, the old gang from the, whatever years, I don't want to pick on anybody, they would always use this verse to talk about men with long hair. I mean, seriously, this is one of the main verses when they would, pick their Bible up and shake and scream and stuff. That was before Toronto when they would shake and scream. But anyway, so Absalom is a picture of Galatians 3:13. Cursed is everyone that hangs upon a tree. He's a picture of, he is probably the most intense picture of rebellion in the nation of history of Israel, like Korah was as well. When Korah rebelled against Moses, there's few that are equal to them. So he's hanging on the tree, Galatians 3:13, quoting Deuteronomy. Cursed is the man that hangs on the tree. There he is, although, it's a symbol of that, of his sin. So he's caught there. The mule continues on, and he's stuck there. A certain man saw it, one of David's men, and came and told Joab, "I saw Absalom hanging in the tree there." I mean, how many hours was he hanging? We don't know. So he runs against Joab. Joab comes back. Joab says, "You saw him. Why do you strike him? I ought to give you 10 shekels of silver and a belt." The man said to Joab, "Though I were to receive 1,000 shekels of silver, I would not raise my hand against the king's son. For in our hearing, the king said, don't touch Absalom." He goes, "You could have given me $1,000,000. I wouldn't have touched him." He goes, "It's not an issue of money. Otherwise, I would have dealt falsely with my own life." He goes, "I'm not going to defy King David." He goes, I know what the score is here. "For there's nothing hidden from the king. And you yourselves would have set yourself against me. You would have all said, he killed Absalom." He goes, "You would have all turned on me." He goes, "No way." I mean, this soldier's been around, hadn't he? I mean, he knows what then Joab says, "I can't linger with you." He says, "I'm not going to sit here and talk to you about all this stuff." He took 3 spears in his hand. He thrust them through Absalom's heart while he was still alive in the midst hanging from the tree. I mean, Joab is good and bad. I mean, obviously, Joab's got this maverick spirit. Joab's got this hold on David because, remember, he helped David kill Uriah, and he's got this thing on David that David just can't stop him. I mean, Joab, he says, "Oh, you sons of Zeruiah." He goes, "You caused me so much trouble." And so Joab I don't want to get too graphic, but he puts it, imagine thrusting a spear through a human being's chest, and he puts 2 more in. I mean, this Joab, that's his spirit. I mean, one would like do it, you know. I mean, then he takes another one and right in the heart again, and then takes a 3rd one and goes after him. This guy is a good soldier. I mean, he is a warrior at least. I mean, in one way, this is the kind of guy David needs, but with a tempered spirit. But do tempered spirit people have the spirit of Joab? You know, I don't know. He did everything like this. He didn't do anything halfway. 10 young men who bore Joab's armor surrounded Absalom and struck and killed him. So these other 10 men, they're Joab's guys. So, you know, they grew up in Joab's home group, so they do it like Joab. They all go, and they all throw their spears. I mean, this guy has really... Okay, I'll restrain myself. Okay, Joab blew the trumpet, and the people returned from pursuing Israel. And Joab held back the people. And they took Absalom, they cast him to a large pit in the woods, and made a very large heap of stones over him. Then all of Israel fled, everyone to his tent. They didn't give him the honorable burial of a king's son. They gave him like stones, like a rebellious son. That was kind of like a picture of stoning him in some ways. And Absalom in his lifetime had set up a pillar for himself, which is in the king's valley. For he said, "I have no son to keep my name in remembrance." He called the pillar after his own name. To this day, it's called Absalom's Monument. So Absalom, before he died, built his own trophy. He built his own monument while he was living. I mean, that's weird, you know, to build your own, because monuments are built after you die. And it says he has no son. In chapter 14:27, he had 3 sons and a daughter. So we know that somewhere there's been tragedy, and because Absalom's only about 30. So from age 20 to 30, he's at least lost 3 sons. So something's been going on in Absalom's life that hasn't been a real good story as well. So he has a lot of private grief that I'm sure is a part of the story that you could only speculate on. Whatever this guy's name is, he reports Absalom's death to David. So this son of Zadok, which is Zadok is, you remember, one of David's most devoted workers. He's the one of the, him and Abiathar are the 2 like high priests at the time, because Zadok was working with Saul, and Abiathar is the one that joined David out in the wilderness, and then when Saul died, the 2 just joined together. But Zadok actually was the most faithful. Zadok stayed true to David, and at the very end, when Adonijah, Saul's son, rose up and said, "I am the king," Abiathar, after all those years of being with David, 30 years, joined Adonijah, and Zadok stayed true with David and knew that Solomon was the true pick of the Lord. And so there's that we'll talk on later, but I just want you to know the kind of man Zadok was. He was loyal to David to the end. So they go and they tell the news. I'm going to skip that part. They come and they give the news to David. And verse 33, chapter 18, 33, the king, David's grief over Absalom, the king was deeply moved. He went up to the chamber over the gate and he wept. And he went, and as he went, he said, "Oh, my son Absalom, my son Absalom, if only I had died in your place. Oh, Absalom, my son." The guilt of what happened with killing Uriah is just crushing David. He said, "Oh, I deserve to have died." He goes, "I'm the one that brought it to this place." I mean, again, Absalom had a rebellious spirit, but David's thinking, if I wouldn't have sinned, the conspiracy would have never have taken hold, because the conspiracy was stronger than Absalom. Conspiracy was a divine judgment on David. He's thinking, my rebellious son could have still been alive, even though he was had a rebellious spirit. So he took the responsibility for himself. So he is known from Psalm 43. I've been corrected, not Psalm 42 and 43. He is known that, so you get that straight, that he would defeat Absalom. He knew that. But again, he was hoping that Absalom would be spared and then sent into some form of exile or some kind of restrictions on him in Israel, but not killed. That's what David was hoping for. But God knew that Absalom would never ever be safe to the nation. The nation would never be safe with Absalom alive. Absalom would eventually rise up and attack. Okay, Joab rebukes David for excessive grief. I mean, grief is right. But remember, 50,000 men have already been killed because of Absalom. I mean, there's a lot of widows and orphans and a lot of moms and dads that have lost their sons already because of Absalom. So the nation is very angry, both sides, that this has even happened. Remember, 50,000 people in a short amount of time have been lost already. If an earthquake hits and 2,000 people died, that's of such grief, the whole nation would be in mourning. 50,000 people died. No, it's 20,000 died by the sword and more died by the woods. So it's 20 plus 20 plus more. So, and then there's other skirmishes. There's other skirmishes that are not recorded. So you're figuring 2,000 or 3,000, 4,000. Okay. Joab rebukes David for excessive grief. Chapter 19, verse 1. Joab was told, "Behold, the king is weeping and mourning for Absalom." So the victory that day was turned into mourning for all the people. For the people. See, these people lost their own children already. And they're going, "David, the guy that killed, that led to the death of our children, has just been killed. Come on. It's a victory. Our other sons aren't going to be killed now." The people heard of it, and the king is grieved for his son. This is not good, what's happened. This is a real weakness on David's part. Again, he's got guilt, and he's got this inordinate kind of affection for his children that seems even stronger than his commitment to obey the Lord or to apply righteousness in his family. The king is grieved for his son at the end of verse 2. And the people stole back into the city that day as people who are ashamed to steal away when they flee in battle. The people were all like discouraged, demoralized, and ashamed, and it was a victory. The king covered his face. The king cried out with a loud voice, and everybody could hear this. "Oh, my son Absalom, my son Absalom, my son." And Joab came into the house and said, "Today you have disgraced your servants who have saved your life. You have, and the life of your sons and daughters, the lives of your wives and the lives of your concubines. And that you love your enemies, you hate your friends." This is wisdom. I mean, Joab had the courage to speak this way to David, and courage to do a lot of other things too. "For you have declared today that you have regard neither for princes or servants. For today I perceive if Absalom was alive and the rest of us were dead, you would be happy right now." I mean, Joab is really speaking it straight here. "Now therefore arise, go and speak comfort to your servants. For I swear by the Lord, if you don't go out, not one will stay with you this night. You will so demoralize the people who have sacrificed themselves on your behalf. And that will be worse for you than all the evil that has come up to now. The whole nation will turn on you before this thing is over." The king arose and sat in the gate and told all the people, saying, "There's the king sitting in the gate." So all the people came before the king, for every one of Israel had fled to his own tent. There was disarray and confusion in the whole nation. Sitting in the gate, meaning he was taking Joab's word. He was cloaking some of his grief, and he was standing there. I mean, sitting like a victorious king was the point. David returns to Jerusalem as king. Yes, chapter 19. 9 to 43. Now all the people were in a dispute through all the tribes of Israel. That's an understatement. Strife fractured the whole nation. There is confusion. Remember, a civil war has just been stopped. Nobody's sure if adulterous David's judgment is over, if Absalom, nobody knows what the score is. Is David going to kill the people who are on Absalom's team? I mean, nobody knows exactly what's happening here, and so there, confusion is everywhere. The king I have here, A, Judah is first to receive David. That's not true. A should be Israel is first to receive David on the notes here. Israel is. Judah is second. That was a mistake. The king saved us from the land of our enemies. From the hand of our enemies. That's what the tribes of Israel said. He's delivered us. Now they're talking about over the last 20 or 30 years. He has delivered us from the hand of the Philistines. Now he has fled from the land because of Absalom. But Absalom, whom we anointed over us. They have to admit they were involved in the treason relationship of treason with Absalom. We anointed him. He has died in battle. Now therefore, why do you say nothing about bringing back the king? David hasn't come back to Jerusalem yet. He is still in his city of Mahanaim, over across the Jordan up north. He's waiting for them to bring him back, but they're scared because are they going to be put to death for betraying David? So there's a tentativeness and a confusion everywhere. And nobody really knows how to interpret the events. Everyone's just hiding in his own tent, waiting for somebody to stand up and blow the trumpet. So David sent Zadok and Abiathar the priest as messengers from here to bring reconciliation. He said, go down and speak to the elders of Judah. He goes, Israel, the 10 tribes of Israel, is ready to take me. Judah, because that's his family, right? He's from the tribe of Judah, like Jesus. That's why Jesus and him are from the same line. He said, tell the elders of Judah, why are you the last to bring the king back to his house? You ought to be making your way here because I'm from your tribe. I'm from your family. So why are you the last to bring the king back to his house since the words of all Israel have come to the king to his very house? So the northern tribes, the 10 northern tribes, have taken the initiative. Verse 12, you are my brethren, Judah. You are my bone and flesh. Why then are you last to bring me back? He says, what's the deal? He goes, you should be the first. And say to Amasa, are you not bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh? God, do so to me and more so if you are not commander of the army before me continually in the place of Joab. Now this is a very interesting move. So he's making a number of statements here. When he puts Amasa as the king, as the commander-in-chief of the army, he's fired Joab. Number one reason he's fired Joab, because he's mad that Joab killed Absalom. That's what I think. I think he's saying, why did you kill my son? I loved him so much. I could have handled him. I would have never given him power again. I would have kept him in check. So I think that he's, instead of grateful towards Joab, he's mad at Joab. And I think that he's tired of being dominated by Joab too. I think David's saying, this is my chance. I'm so mad. I don't care what he says. And if he gives Amasa the head position's commander-in-chief, what is he signaling to the whole nation? There's no penalty for treason. Everybody is free. That's a major good political move in terms of unifying the nation. He is saying, David is in essence saying, the nation's been under judgment because of me. I think that David has a sympathy, grace here, because he knows he was the reason there was a conspiracy in the nation. David knows that. So he says, I'm going to give everybody the freebie, because I know if I wouldn't have sinned, there'd never been a civil war. So the whole nation sees he's going to pick a mess. Clinton becoming president and picking Bush to be his main aide. It was just like, a bizarre kind of thing. This was completely unheard of, that he took the enemy general and made him his head general. But the whole nation said, well, I guess we all work now. And that was a powerful statement. And also, Amasa had tremendous influence on the nation. I mean, he was the powerful man like Abner was beforehand. Verse 14. So Amasa swayed the hearts of all the men of Judah, just as the heart of one man. So they sent the word to the king saying, return you and all your servants. So Amasa, it was a great choice, because all of Judah and Israel turned their heart towards David. I mean, it was a tremendous move of diplomacy. And again, David's taking responsibility for the civil war instead of judging them for it. Now, just so you know, in chapter 20, verse 10, Joab kills Amasa. He gets mad and takes him out. So he goes after and kisses him on the hand and sticks him with a sword too. And so David stuck with Joab. He says, well, it's you and me again. Here we are. So the king returned, came to the Jordan, and Judah came to Gilgal. So it worked. The whole delegation from Judah came and says, okay, we're with the 10 tribes. So when they say the 10 tribes in Judah, what's 10 plus 1? That's 11. That leaves one out because there's 12 tribes. They never put the tribe of Levi in that equation because the tribe of Levi did not have any land. And when they speak of the tribes, they're talking about the distribution of the land. So there's the 10 tribes to the north. In other words, that was the like counties. They were like 10 counties or states, each to a tribe. And then the tribe of Judah had more than all of them. I don't mean all of them together, but it had the most as one tribe. So it was typically the tribe of Judah, which was the biggest landmass, against the other 10 tribes. It'd kind of be like Texas, you know, for you Texans in America. And the rest, you know, they say it's the best country in America. But anyway, that's what the Texans say. And so it was that kind of thing. But Levi is never counted in the mix. Because you always think the 10 and the tribes in Judah, where's the other guy at, you know? And Levi is scattered throughout the whole nation, and they have to support him with the tithes and offerings, and that's how that worked, okay? B. David, he forgives Shimei. Now the two guys, Shimei and Ziba, have to face David. David's king now. So Shimei goes, oh no. He goes, I didn't think you would make it. And so Shimei, a Benjamite, because you know, a Benjamite, who's from Benjamin? Saul is, okay? Saul's from the tribe of Benjamin. So he's the one that was cursing because David had triumphed over Saul. Hastened. That means real quick, he heard the news, came down with men of Judah to meet King David. And verse 17, and there were 1,000 men of Benjamin with him. I mean, this was a powerful man. He had 1,000 men with him. So, I mean, he was not an inconsequential military leader. He had 1,000 men with him. That's why he was not afraid to take on all the others. He was not a man standing alone. He was, you know, he had 1,000 men when he was cursing David. I don't think the 1,000 men were there, but he could have rallied and had a significant skirmish. And Ziba came down and went over the Jordan before the king. You know, he's kind of fearing the consequences of his deceit as well. Maybe he didn't think David was going to make it. You know, and he was playing both sides. You know, he wanted to get the title deed with David's stamp on it in case David died so he could take over Mephibosheth's land. But we skipped some of that part, so maybe you don't know what I mean by all that. In our last session, we skipped some of it. So then he said to the king, verse 19, do not let my Lord impute iniquity to me. Remember what wrong your servant did on the day that my Lord left the king, left Jerusalem, for the king should take it to heart. For I, your servant, know I have sinned. Therefore I am first to come down of all the house of Joseph to go down to meet the Lord the king. But Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, answered and said, shall not Shimei be put to death for this? So Shimei has been repenting. Verse 20, he said, I have sinned. I blew it. Forgive me. And Abishai, Joab's little brother, says, kill him. I mean, these sons of they were such trouble to David all the time. And so Abishai says, kill the guy. And David says, what am I going to do with you and your brother? He says, you guys, because the other guy, what's that? No, Joab's not dead. No, the third one died way back in chapter 3. He says, what am I going to do with you guys that you should be adversaries to me today? Shall I put any man to death in Israel? For I do not know that today, that I am king over Israel. Therefore the king said to Shimei, you shall not die. And the king swore to him. And the king held his word. He said, hey, there's been enough bloodshed. He goes, just forget it. The nation were unified. I don't want to pay any debts. Let the whole thing be forgotten. Now, the real technical people wouldn't have liked that. David said, let's just call it peace everywhere. Let's move on. For the past is the past. In 1 Kings 2, verse 8, when he talks to Solomon on his deathbed, he says, Shimei, don't kill him. He says, unless he does wrong, but he said, I vowed to him that he would live. So David kept his word to this guy at the end. So now Mephibosheth comes, and he makes it right with him. And so David says, What was the deal with you anyway? Why didn't you join me? In verse 27, he says, I was slandered. He said, I didn't, he says, you know, the guy took my wheelchair. I was stuck at home. He went and he lied. He goes, I was here. I couldn't get to you. He goes, literally, the guy over me left me here. And so David, this is negative here in verse 29. David, because there's so much chaos in the nation, so much disruption, he doesn't even want to hear the case. He goes, this is like, you know, priority number 6,000. He goes, just divide the land in half, which is bad because Ziba actually lied and got half the land. And Mephibosheth had all the land. And Mephibosheth said, I'm just so happy that you're alive and I love you. I don't care. He can have all the land. No, David says, nah, half and half. Which, this isn't real justice. David, again, it's way down the priority list. The whole nation is broken right now. He says, oh, we'll work on it later. He says, but for now, just divide the land in two. Okay, now, this Barzillai was the man 80 years old. He comes and David blesses him. Verse 32, now Barzillai was a very aged man, 80 years old. He was the one that gave David supplies back when he was running. And Barzillai says, David says, what can I give you? From verse 33, 34, 35. And he says in verse 35, hey, I'm an 80-year-old guy. He goes, I don't even know if it tastes good or not. You know, he goes, forget me. He goes, don't give me anything. But he goes on in verse 37. He says, give it to my son, who is your servant, this Chimham. He says, give it to my son. Bless him with the inheritance. And so Barzillai's son gets blessed throughout his whole life with a certain portion of land near Bethlehem and a certain pension. So David blesses him for his former kindness. You find that actually in Jeremiah 41, verse 17, where it references that this man was given land that was in Israel for many years, in Jeremiah 41, 17. Okay. E, Israel receives David. David went on to Gilgal, and half of the people of Israel went with him. And just as all the men of Israel went to the king and said to him, why have our brethren, the men of Judah, stolen you away and brought the king and his household and all David's men with him across the Jordan? So the men of Israel come and they say, hey, you know, Judah stole you. They came and made a little secret pact with you at night. And they're secretly trying to bring you back. We're the ones that had the idea of putting you in the palace first. Why are you going with Judah? Why are you acting real nice towards them? Verse 43 is, so the men of Israel answered the men of Judah and said, we have 10 shares in the king. Therefore we have also more right to David than you have. Why then do you despise us? So there was a lot of tension between, you know, who honored the king first and who betrayed the king. I mean, this stuff confuses the nation for years. Who was loyal? Who wasn't loyal? Who was with Absalom? Who was forced to be with Absalom and who really wanted to be with him? So there was a lot of tension between the two. It says, why then do you despise us? Were we not the first to advise bringing back the king? That this is the northern tribes, the 10 northern tribes. It was our ideas first, yet the words of the men of Judah were fiercer than the words of the men of Israel. This is the seed of the breaking of the nation, which breaks in about two generations. It's at peace throughout of all Solomon's reign for 40 years. But after Solomon's reign, Solomon's son Rehoboam and another king called Jeroboam, they break because of this division right here. They break it 40 years later and they never ever unite again. But this is the beginning of the fracture of the nation of Israel. It has a civil war after 40 years of Solomon's reign, which was totally peaceful. But the animosities were brewing and they completely broke and divided after this time. So this Absalom thing really did hurt the nation long term. They never were cured from it. Roman numeral 2. Sheba's rebellion. We'll end with this chapter. This is this is Israel rising up again. Now there happened to be a rebel whose name was Sheba. He was also a Benjaminite. He could capitalize on the sentiment for Saul. You know, he says, hey, the kingdom's been with us. He's a powerful man. This guy is really missing something. He does not understand that Saul was defeated by God, Absalom was defeated by God, but he thinks he can pull it off. He's going to go against the anointed of God. He blows a trumpet. He capitalizes on the fact that he's a Benjaminite like Saul was, like Jonathan was. He blew a trumpet and he said, here he speaks for everybody, we have no share in David, nor does we have an inheritance of the sons of Israel. In other words, this is a sign of revolt. He goes, Israel, David's never going to be nice to us anyway. You know, he's against the 10 tribes. So every man of Israel deserted David. I mean, you think, my goodness. I mean, the nation was so fragile right now. Every man deserted David. Now remember, David's only the second king. The nation has been fragmented for hundreds of years. I mean, for the 400 years since Moses. It's been fragmented. I guess it would be 600 years since Moses. It's been fragmented. It's only been unified under Saul and David. So in their history is they break easy. So they had no history of sticking together. So when a trauma came, they all went to their own tribes and they became tribal with feudal kind of animosities against each other. So he blew the trumpet. So every man deserted David. I know, you just want to cry, don't you? And they followed Sheba. But the men of Judah remained loyal to David, because that's the family he was from. And David came to his house in Jerusalem, and the king took the 10 women, his concubines, whom he had left to keep the house. He put them in seclusion and supported them, but he did not go into them, so they were shut up to the day of their death, living in widowhood. So the first thing David does in this issue of Sheba's revolt, see, hides the harem, because that was an act of treason. The first thing that Absalom did was he went and he violated David's harem, because that was saying, I had title to the throne. And so the first thing he does, instead of leaving the harem unprotected, he protects them, because he knows that's the first thing that Sheba would want to do, to make a major statement of treason against David. In other words, they burn the bridge, and it's like they can't turn back if they do that. It's like seizing the throne. It's a statement, I all but have the throne in my hand now, if they could do this. The king said to Amasa, assemble the men of Judah for me within 3 days and present yourself here. So he is allowed to be the commander-in-chief. And again, instead of being penalized for being with Absalom, Amasa is, has this position to try to rally the whole nation. So Amasa went to assemble the men of Judah. But he delayed longer than the time set, because I think there was so much difficulty and bad feelings, opposition still to David, chaos everywhere. David said, do it as quick as you can. Do it within 3 days. He couldn't pull it off within 3 days, which is telling you there's chaos still in the nation. That's the point that they want you to deduce from that sentence. C, Abishai pursues Sheba. So David said to Abishai, he says, now Sheba will do us more harm than Absalom. Take your Lord, because see, now what's happened, Absalom has come, David forgave everybody, but now there's animosity between the captains themselves now, because they're not going to forgive each other. And so now this revolt is actually more serious than the other one, because now the captains, it's not just whether they're picking Absalom or David, they're actually against one another because of the way they brought David back. I mean, their offense is like everywhere. He goes, we're in more trouble than we were under Absalom. Because it was just between me and my son. Now it's between them. Now they've made it personal between each other. Because of the way that Judah tried to bring David back and tried to bump Israel out of the way and get the advantage. That's what was going on here. He says, take your Lord's servants and pursue him, lest he find for himself fortified cities and escape us. He goes, stop him, because if he gets in a big fort, it's going to be hard to break it. Speed was essential. Now Joab is under his brother Abishai right now, and Joab has got wounded pride, and he's got a plan in his heart. He's going to go kill Amasa. So Joab's men, he had the 600 of the bodyguard. That's who those guys are. They were the mercenaries, the bodyguard. They all went out of Jerusalem to pursue Sheba. Verse 8, and when Joab murders Amasa. And when they were at the large stone, which is Gibeon, Amasa came before him, and Joab was dressed with his battle armor, and on it was a belt with a sword fastened and its sheath at his hips. And as he was going forward, the sword fell out. I think the sword fell out on purpose. I think he drops the sword, and because he greets Amasa here, in verse 9 it says, are you in health, my brother? And Joab took him by the beard with his right hand to kiss him. And see, Joab could not have approached Amasa with a sword in his hand, because Amasa would have said, hey, what's the sword in your hand? Because that was like an act of war to do that. You never went with your sword in your hand to greet somebody, because nobody could ever know. So he gets next to him, he kind of fumbles, and his sword falls out. And he goes, oh, excuse me. And he picks it up and he goes, my brother. So he gets close to him with a sword in his hand. So that's what he's doing there. He's saying, like, you know, I'm not breaking the etiquette of the day. My sword just accidentally fell out. Verse 10. But Amasa did not notice the sword that was in Joab's hand. I mean, he wasn't paying attention to it. He wasn't worried about that, because he's walking up to him and he stumbled over it, thought no big deal, and he struck him with it in the stomach. And his entrails poured out on the ground. Well, you give Joab credit. He didn't strike him again. So you either say, you read that one of two ways. Either he was in a hurry, he was tired, or the first one was so graphic he didn't need to. You don't know how exactly to read that. Then he died. The Joab and Abishai pursued Sheba. Meanwhile, one of Joab's men stood near Amasa and said, "Whoever favors Joab..." So here's Amasa. You know, he's been the commander-in-chief. He's laying on the ground with a five-star general. He's just been murdered by another general. And then one of the Joab's men, you remember, one of these guys from his home group stood up and said, "Who's ever with Joab and David, follow," you know. And like they throw David in there. And so they go, yuck, back to the good old days. I mean, Joab's been with David for 30 years. And so it would have been pretty easy to kick back into the old David-Joab mold, you know. So Amasa wallowed in the blood in the middle of the highway. You kind of worry about think about the personality of the guy that wrote this. I mean, he is being anointed, but sometimes his own personality comes out, don't you? I mean, there's different... I mean, when you read Ruth, you don't ever read anything like that. But anyway, Amasa wallowed in his blood in the middle of the highway. And when the man saw that all the people stood still, he moved Amasa from the highway to the field and threw a garment over him. And he saw that everyone who came up on him halted. So everybody walks up to Amasa and they see him on the ground, just blood everywhere, and they halt. They're like, whoa! Because he was a famous... I mean, he was the commander-in-chief. I mean, he's at least a famous five-star general before that. He led Absalom's troops because of his valor and his might. Here he is laying dead. They're going, how did the commander-in-chief die? They're looking at him going, that's our captain down there. Verse 13. And when he was removed from the highway, all the people went after Joab to pursue Sheba. So they're all with Joab again. And so Joab subdues Sheba. He went through all the tribes to this one city. It's way up in the north, about 4 miles west of Dan. Clear up at the very top of the map up there. They besieged the city. Verse 16. Joab says, we're going to tear the city down. This wise woman from the city says, wait, let's talk sense here. She says, give me a little bit of time and we'll kill him for you. Don't tear our city down. We'll kill him and throw his head over the wall. And so Joab says, okay. So they give her a little bit of time and they trap Sheba in there and they cut his head off. And in verse 21, at the very end, they throw his head over the wall. And Joab says, okay, good. Okay, he's dead. I'm happy with it now. And so the woman, verse 22, in her wisdom went to all the people and they cut off the head of Sheba. They threw it to Joab. Joab took the head. I mean, he didn't mind this stuff. I mean, obviously the Lord wants this in here for us to know it. But the Lord does choose certain personalities to write. You know, the human element comes even though the anointing of the Spirit is on them. And I just wonder who the guy the Lord chose to inspire this. You wonder what kind of guy he is. Then he blew a trumpet. He went from the city, every man to his tent. Joab returned to the king at Jerusalem. Now, that's a little strange. He's coming back to Jerusalem, and we're just here at the very last parts here, and he comes to Jerusalem, and now David has fired Joab, but possibly hasn't talked to him since. So that's going to be a little strained. He walks into the old courtroom, and you know the court of David, I mean, and he's saying, "Well, David," he goes, "I've been with you for years. You fired me, but I killed the guy that you replaced me. Do you want to fight now, or do you want to just end it?" And it says in verse 23, "And Joab was over all the army." So. Which David yields to him again. And this list, verse 23 to 26, is nearly the same as the list. It's David's cabinet. It's his head officials. It's chapter 8, verse 16 to 18. There's very few differences. One notable difference, the only notable difference we'll end with this, is where? Verse 26. That his sons are no longer the chief ministers under David, like in chapter 8, verse 16 to 18. David's sons were in those positions before. Now David has another guy who's the head of that. It's like the nation, he's saying, hey, sons, he goes, I need a little break, you know, like public image. I don't need one of my sons in this position. Give me a little bit of time. So he actually replaces his sons with this other guy. Amen.